Welcome to the Divided Kingdom, the evening news program that many of you have come to know and trust. This is Elizabeth Cuppett Caverly speaking, and today we are having a milestone interview. It has been some time since I talked to my dear friend, Anita Dittmann, the author of Trapped in Hitler's Hell. Welcome to the program, Anita.
Thank you. Thank you. I'm happy to be here. Here at the interview, yeah, okay, you understood what I meant.
Yes, and it's so wonderful to have Anita's voice. Listeners, we know that World War II is beginning to fade because I read the other day that only 1 million veterans are left from that war. It used to be we talked about the World War I veterans disappearing, but now it is World War II. And Anita's story is one that you will never forget, and several times during this interview I hope to mention how you can get her book, Trapped in Hitler's Hell, and you can call Lighthouse Trails Publishing at the toll-free number 866-876-3910. And again, I hope that you have a pen and you'll note this number. This would be a wonderful Christmas gift or a birthday gift any time of the year, especially those of you who are listening who are grandparents. You want your children and your grandchildren to be strengthened for the times of persecution that may well be coming to America. Again, that toll-free number is 866-876-3910. And I believe the book is $12.99. Let me just check it, $12.95, and I think all you pay is $5 a flat shipping rate. So what could be more reasonable than the price of this wonderful book? Now, in America, which is the country that Anita came to so long ago in the 1940s, after surviving a horrendous ordeal under the Hitlerian regime, in America, we see that things are changing. Recently, it has been announced that there are white boxes in the Seattle area that now can use your cell phone to find out almost instantaneously where you are. And at the same time, many Americans are not aware that draconian laws are being put in place, such as the National Defense Authorization Act signed by our president, President Obama. And in this law, the auspices of this would make it enabling to just pick up Americans randomly, take them away, never seen again. We don't think we're quite at those times yet, but we don't know. As we see the hand of God moving ever closer in judgment on this country, as the states begin to approve same-sex marriage more and more and more, and as the abortion clinics continue with mostly silence from most of the mainstream churches, we know that God can't wait forever. But we pray on this program that we'll be reaching many more of you soon. We will be reaching you in York, Pennsylvania, and in Kansas City, in that area. And this program today, we'll have a part two, so you don't want to forget, listeners, to tune in next week. We will definitely be playing part two of Anita's story. And now, Anita, your book has a scriptural foreword, I believe, here, if I can find it, and it is from Psalms. Psalms 57:1, be merciful to me, O God, be merciful to me, for my soul trusts in you, and in the shadow of your wings I will make my refuge until these calamities have passed. And your book begins with a new era, Heil Hitler. Could you tell us, first of all, Anita, about your family? Tell about the members of your family and how your life was, and then move into the story of your ballet career, your short-lived ballet career.
Okay, I'll start. Okay, my, excuse me, still have a cold to overcome. My mother came from a Jewish background, and yet at age 19, she kind of deviated from God altogether and joined a very strange religion. My father was an atheist.
And perhaps you would mention that. Was it something like the New Age religion?
I don't know. It was called Theosophy. And Theosophy is very similar to Hinduism, but a little different. And my father was an atheist and very proud of the fact that he was an atheist. So as a result, my sister and I had no Christian nurture whatsoever. However, God was very gentle and kind to me, and he gave me a body that was very agile. So my mother enrolled me in ballet, and my teacher was a retired ballerina. And in her younger years, she had been very famous. And when she saw my talent, she said, "Girl, I'm going to make a famous ballerina out of you." And she said to me all the perks that I would have. And then she added to it, "People will literally worship you." I didn't know what that meant at age 4. But I gave it my all, and I loved every moment that I practiced. I was about 5.5 years old when Adolf Hitler came to power. And at that time, the scene of my life began to change abruptly. Hitler had a grandiose idea. He was going to make Germany into a master race. He called them the Aryans. And he was going to purify the entire country of all undesirables. And of course, the Jews were at the top of that list. He hated the Jews with a passion. Pretty soon we heard loud music, men, women, and children dressed in Hitler uniforms, waving little Nazi flags, and out of the windows of the Nazi people, the flag was flying in the wind. And the worst of it all was, pretty soon we learned all about what these uniforms meant and what these people did. And the first name we heard of the SS, of course, they were Hitler's protective league, and they also had different duties. And then, of course, then there were the brown shirts. Soon we heard a name, concentration camps, and we already heard about relatives and friends that had been taken to those concentration camps, and they never were heard of again. So things got pretty scary. And to top it off, during the early part of Hitler's government, my father left us. He was the Aryan, and he did not wish to be married to a Jewish woman. And as a result, our wonderful, somewhat wealthy life that we had enjoyed came to a sudden stop overnight. My mother, my older sister, and I had to move into a tiny little apartment, but it was clean, and it was still in a nice little district far away from the big city, because my hometown was about 568,000, very large city. Well, time changed. We were struggling with poverty, but still we were glad we were not in the camp yet. But that didn't last too long either. Freedom was short-lived. But then there was always my ballet, and when I danced all my cares away. And when I was about, almost 7, my teacher said, "Anita, you are doing so well. You are now dancing with the big girls. And we have a gala performance coming up, and you will be dancing solo. You'll no longer be dancing in a group." And when time came for me to get on stage, I was a little scared, to say the least, because I was not used to everybody focusing on me. I had learned to keep my head down and try not to attract a lot of attention. But when the music started, I thought I was floating in midair. I just forgot. I was totally oblivious to my surrounding. I just was in seventh heaven. And when it stopped, I was so surprised when I heard this overwhelming applause. Well, I went home that night with my ballet slippers under my pillow during in my bed and dreamed happy dreams, only to be awakened the next morning when my mother stopped in and said, "Anita, wake up. I have to read something to you." So there was there was a newspaper, and she read to me from the front page. All the names were discussed on that front page, all the critiques for each student. And when they came to mine, they said, the performance was superb, far above Anita's age, but the German people are no longer willing to be entertained by a Jew. And in addition, there was no money left for ballet lessons, and right there I saw my hopes and dreams totally being shattered into tiny little fragments. I wept bitterly, but my mother said to me, "Anita, don't get swallowed up by, you know, self-pity, because it was still free, and that won't last much longer. Look around you where people are already being picked up." It was about 2 weeks later that my friends took me to an Easter service in their little church, the little church that I had worshipped in with my friends for many months. I was so glad when I heard about Jesus. And that day, in a very unique way, Jesus came into my life. I won't go into detail because I have many, many more things to share with you.
I think, Anita, you could go into detail because we have two full programs. I think it would be good for people to know what does it mean to be born again? What happened to you?
Yeah, well, I had heard about Jesus, and my friends had taken me to church many times, and I had listened to the services. This was so beautiful. I was sitting there looking at the stained glass windows that I had viewed many times, the windows that described, the windows that I had looked at so many times, but that morning it was different. The morning sun was shining through those windows and illuminated them, and these windows depicted Christ's birth, life, and resurrection. And it was, I'm just seeing what I felt like Jesus was stepping out of those windows and was taking me with him, walking with me, promising me to always be there. And I remembered some of the Bible passages that I had already learned where it says, I will keep you, and I'm going to hold your hand, and I will never leave you. It's in Hebrews. Well, I came to realize there and then, and the sermon was somewhat geared to that, that God did not want me to live to be worshipped like my teacher had promised me. God wanted me to live to worship him. Yes. Poverty was great, money was scant, and yet we were still together, and I had Jesus now. And I remember I was so happy when I went back to try to get home. I ran home with my friends, and when I burst into the door, I was so enthusiastic, and I wanted so much to have my sister and my mother to listen to me, what I had to say. You see, it wasn't just a childish fantasy, as they described it. It was a reality. At the moment Christ came into my life, I had an inner peace that I had never, ever noticed before, and a security much, much greater and much more beautiful than the financial security we had during those first rather wealthy 5.5 years.
And Anita, I believe that you've told me later in life, God never ever permitted you to go back into ballet. Anytime you would think of this, you were told rather severely that was not for you. Isn't that right?
Well, yeah, it was three times. Three times I had a chance to go back into ballet. But I always got horribly sick, and it wasn't an emotional sickness. It was a physical sickness. Once I had mumps, and another time I had something else, and I realized then it wasn't meant for me. Christ wanted me to focus on Him and not become all enamored by ballet. Because I've often thought, I wonder what would have happened if I had stayed in ballet. Would I have given God first place in my life? Maybe not. Maybe God knew that. I have no idea. But life changed abruptly. And what's so marvelous?
And Anita, I'd like to interject here that when we read celebrity magazines in America today, there is such a drought. There is such a hopelessness as the people there pursue the ungodly lifestyles and their children get more depressed and are on drugs. And it is a very empty thing to be in the world of fame and adulation. And God had something very, very special for you to do and to witness. Today,
yes.
You are a witness to all of us,
yes,
because of your life and how God was faithful. And could you mention the special pastor? Was he the pastor when you were saved?
He came into my life a little after I had been saved. Yeah, that... It was about 1938, very early 1938, when I was very blessed to no longer have to go to school in the city schools where I was persecuted by my teachers and some of my peers, although I had a few friends. But this pastor was, he belonged to, I'm not... mentioning any denomination, but he belonged to a church where that was really close to Christ. He never ever sold out to the Nazis. He did not take out the Jesus Christ picture and crucifix from the walls to put Hitler's picture on, and he didn't. And he spoke the pure word. He was careful in what he had said, what he could say, because there were plainclothes SS and Gestapo people sitting in their congregation listening.
And we would point out that he was a Protestant minister, and Anita, sad to say, there are some parallels growing here in America, because under Lyndon Baines Johnson as president, the 501c3 churches came into being, and this effectively muzzled them, that they really won't talk about political issues such as homosexuality and abortion, and now it has been reported there are clergy response teams, and these would be pacification factors at a time of concentration camps. So we can see the divide is coming here too. There are still some pastors who are Black Robe Regiment pastors. They will stand up and tell the truth. But it's interesting when you talk about the changes in the churches. What happened when the crucifix and the pictures of Jesus were removed? Was Hitler's picture put in there?
Yes, yes, yes. But this pastor didn't. And it's just a miracle that he was never in a camp. And he had, and I found out much, much later through a friend when I lived up north the last few years, that he was so bold in 1933 already. He wrote a letter to Adolf Hitler telling him that he was very displeased how he is treating the Jewish people. And I'm amazed that he... that they didn't pick him up. I mean, the angels were watching over him. God knew that we needed him, and it was an inner city church. They were simple people, but you know, in Germany at that time, sometimes poor, simple people were the best because they really stuck with us who were being persecuted. They were kind to us and would help us. But this man was so precious. We finally attended his church. He came to our apartment where we lived one day in early in 1938, and he gave us each a Bible, and he said, you know, I'm not forcing you to come, but I have many people like you who are Jewish or, you know, partly Jewish, and they come to Bible study, and many of them have already accepted Christ in their life. Or rather, I should say, Christ has accepted them. We don't, you know, that's really the way it works, that he accepts us. And first my mother was a little bit, you know, skeptical, but I noticed finally she said, girls, let's get dressed, let's take the streetcar and drive to the inner city, ride to the inner city. And she said, well, we don't have to go along with it, but we could at least try. Well, it was just a few months after Bible study and going to church that my mother became a Christian. It wasn't only because what this man taught and what he preached. It was his total Christian lifestyle. I said, if I could nominate someone in my lifetime for a special reward for being totally Christ-like, I would nominate him. He was bold. He loved the Jewish people. And it was so wonderful when my mother became a Christian. She said to me one day, she said, why was I so stupid and so dragging my feet? You came to know Christ and worship him and pray to him when you were just a little kid. And I said, Mom, I wasn't just a little kid. I had to grow up awfully fast. No, I said it was. And yet I keep saying to myself, Christ used to say to people, unless you become like little children, you cannot gain the kingdom of God. And it's true, because children have a pure, beautiful, Christ-like way of accepting things. They don't question. They believe. They trust. And that's what I did. I trusted the Lord.
Yes, and well, as things moved on, I hope you will tell us about how God warned you and prepared you in a dream.
Yeah. That was a little later. I just want to mention one thing before we go on with it. We just had been baptized and accepted into the church. Then very soon, November 8th, 1938, came. It was the famous Kristallnacht, where the Nazis burned all the synagogues except one. They smashed the fronts of Jewish businesses. They dragged old men out by their beard and dragged them off in police wagons, and some of them never came back. It was horrifying. It was so awful. And it was a German neighbor nearby that came early in the morning, and she said, Hilde, it was a horrible night. You see, we didn't have a TV, or we didn't even have a radio. And she told us what had happened. She said, Hilda, don't send the girls to school. And I know my teachers in the parochial school would have understood why we weren't there.
Yes, and I would like to point out here again that these parallels between the horrible brutality of that night, the brown shirts and all of this, mm-hmm. we have the trend of the TSA in the airports, and a very brave legislator in Congress, Marsha Blackburn, I believe from Tennessee, has been leading a one-woman fight to try to bring this organization back under lawful orders. And when we find out that this TSA has actually brutalized little handicapped children in wheelchairs, it's just dreadful. And I'm wondering, too, when we looked into doing some more research about Hitler's era, the T4 program that picked up handicapped people and children and took them away, and the parents never knew that they were annihilated. Did you ever get any rumors about this, that people who were mentally defective, or defective, did you ever hear of this?
Yeah, we knew about it. Not only handicapped people, but older people like me. And I
really?
Had my own, oh yeah, they were ransacking all the apartment buildings in the vicinity where my aunt and my grandmother lived. And my grandmother must have been about my age. I'm 86. And so the older people, some were up on the third floor. They came down, and they had befriended my aunt and my grandmother. They were Germans. They're Aryans, as Hitler called them. They came, and they picked up my grandmother. They carried her up the steps into their apartment, and they had made a special kind of place for my grandmother to be, and they put a big, big piece of furniture, a wardrobe. We didn't have, like you have closets. We didn't have those closets. We had wardrobes, and they pushed the wardrobe in front of the door that they had closed, but they had fixed it so that my grandmother wouldn't be frightened. They explained to her why they're doing it, and she was quiet, and she had had to just, be very, very careful that she didn't cough or anything. And
yes.
The Nazis came, and they searched for her. They were going to pick her up and take her in a police wagon and kill her. It was horrible what was going on. It was so frightening, and we already heard from
relatives. Did they find her?
No, they didn't.
They did not find her?
No, she lived out her life until she was about my age, and then she passed
away
normally. But it was awful. I know that people who had Down syndrome children, Germans even, who had had Down syndrome children, they would not ever dare to take them outside because they would be picked up and taken
away. They would be picked up.
Oh, it's horrible.
So it was a hell on earth. And did you feel that, as you look back on this, did you feel that some of this came on Germany because the people had turned away from Jesus?
Yes, definitely. I've noticed that in our schools here, and I want to intercept here, when I first moved up to the Brainerd area in 1993, I had all kinds of wonderful speaking engagements in many of the schools. Sometimes I would speak 3-4 times a day, giving my message about my life during the Holocaust. No more. And I remember just recently I got a phone call from a man who was a liaison in Rogers between the school, the high school, and the public. And he left a message on my phone machine, and he said, "I heard about you from some young people who heard you speak, and they talked to me," he said. They were so touched by it, and they really just asked me to please invite you to come and speak. Would you come in fall? This was the beginning of, summer school, summer vacation. And sure enough, I said, well, I better tell him what my message is all about. And so I left a message on his phone, and I said, "I feel very honored that you're inviting me. However, mine has Christ in it, my message. And
yes.
Let me know what you think about it." And so he left another message. Some of we were being phone tagged. And he left the other message, and he said, "I'm sorry, unless you can leave Christ out of your message, you can't come and speak in my school, in our school." And I then called him back, and he answered, and I said, "Well, sir," I said, "I'm sorry, but I can't leave Christ of it. He's the center of my life. He was the very one that carried me through all these 12 and a half years of the Holocaust. It's a miracle I am alive. And Christ was with me every step of the way. I cannot leave him out. That I said that would be very unbiblical, because he specifically, Christ spoke to the people, he said, anyone that will not support me, he doesn't use the word support, I can't think of it now, but anyway, who will not defend me before people, I will not defend them before my Father in heaven. And I took that to heart, and I did not leave Jesus. I said to him, I'm sorry, but maybe sometimes these kids could come to church and invite me to their church. I cannot leave him out. And he said, well, then you can come and speak. And I saw it more and more.
You saw it more and more coming in this country, parallels to what happened to you.
Exactly.
And this is so important, because this program, we hope, will soon be reaching more people in York, Pennsylvania, and in Kansas City. And, of course, we're on Global Star Communications, a wonderful network that does reach into Europe. And we hope that some people will be hearing this message as God wills, and that the remnant, the believers who are going to stand up and tell the truth and who are going to not compromise, will be strengthened for the years ahead, because many, many things can come. But as you say, God showed you in your life so many times that he was faithful to you. And now let's move to, as things worsened and your warning dream.
Well, I tell you, let me just come up with something that's important, too. That
certainly.
As time passed on, one day in 1939, early in 1939, our pastor called us into his office and after church, and he said, Hilda, Hella, and Anita, I have good news for you. I have gotten in touch with an organization in Berlin that would help you people financially. You may have to raise a little bit of money, but that would help you to go to England. They are already working on your visas, so it can't be too long before you will be able to leave. And we would, I mean, that was the highlight of our, life. Hope, it gave us hope. And every day, I remember during summer vacation, I would be running down the steps from second floor and try to wait for the mailman to bring that particular envelope. And sure enough, in July of 1939, they brought my sister's visa, and they reassured us that our visas were, my mother's and mine, were on the way, and to be patient. And on August 31st, we escorted my sister to the railroad station, where she would begin her journey by train through Holland and then ultimately by boat. And we reassured her that any day we would be reunited with her. But unfortunately, that day never came, because on the 1st of September, Hitler had declared war on Poland, and all the borders had been closed. No car, no plane, no nothing went over the border, and all borders were closed to foreign mail, so that no foreign mail would get into our country. And with that, my mother and I were trapped in Hitler's hell, and we knew what kind of a future was awaiting us. But one thing our pastor had told us another time, he said, Hilda and Anita, I tried very, very hard to get you out, and we knew that. But he said, you know, even if you and your mother would be separated someday, remember, even if a death camp was waiting for both of you, or at least for one of you, don't feel bad. Because, he said, it sounds, maybe you don't accept what I have to say, but he said, death is but the door to eternal life, and someday you both will be reunited up in heaven with him. And that gave us a lot of strength. And I tell you, We used to love to go to church. To us, it was like an oasis in a desert of racism and cruelty. But pretty soon, my mother was drafted into heavy factory labor where she toiled many hours. And on when I was about 15, my principal came into my classroom and he said, "Didman, pack up your things. I'm going to have to give you something." So he met me in the hall, handed me a writing from the Gestapo headquarters, informing me, due to my Jewish heritage, I'm permanently suspended from school with no return. And he added to it, he said, "It's high time that the German government is cleaning our school system of riffraff such as yourself." About 2 months later, I too was drafted into heavy factory labor. My mother was on the same shift, the day shift, and we were so grateful that we could work together. We worked 10
and
hours
let's backtrack.
A day.
Let's just backtrack a minute. When I looked over your book this afternoon, also it struck me about your experience in Berlin and with the so-called Christian lady who starved you. I think you should tell about that a little bit before you get back. Okay,
I will. For a while, my pastor found a place in Berlin for that a Christian lady, so-called Christian, a Christian lady had offered to have me stay with her and even pay my tuitions. And he thought that would be nice to go for me to have education because my father had completely separated from us and he refused to pay the tuition in school. And many times I lost time because I couldn't go to school. And then the pastor had given my mother money for my school tuition and said that somebody in church had given that. And I know it came from his own pocketbook.
And, God used him as a wonderful surrogate father when your own father more or less abandoned you, didn't he?
Yeah, he was. He was my father figure, my mentor, and he was a wonderful, wonderful influence on my mother. Well, at one point he said, "You know, this lady would take care of you. She would, you would live there." And then you, because her children had been evacuated to England because she had had a Jewish husband who was in Shanghai waiting for her to come and join him. And during that time, I could be going to school. Well, at first, I thought this was wonderful, but I found out right away that that lady was very cruel underneath all that wonderful Christian exterior. And she would literally take away my food rations and give them to her tailor-maid that occupied a room next to mine in the daytime, who would sew all kinds of clothes for her so that she would look nice when she goes to Shanghai. Needless to say, she didn't look very well in anything because she was huge. But you know, that wouldn't have been so bad, but her personality was dreadful. And she would keep me from having enjoyment with some of my classmates. She said, "I want to teach you how to deny yourself life and things." I said, "Ma'am," I said, "I've already learned that over the past 10 years. And she became so, it was terrible. And the fact that she took away my food rations, especially meat, I got terribly thin. I lost a tremendous amount of weight. I was hungry when I went to school, hungry when I came back. And I remember one time I was sick with a sore throat, so she put me into my room, turned off the lights, and said that I couldn't get out of bed except to go to the bathroom, and that and then her maid, she had a maid, the maid came and excuse me, literally shoved a bowl of hot substance, which was composed of water with salt in it and some burnt cream of wheat, and it was terrible, and I was not allowed to come out of that room. I mean, she was so dreadful. And when I had lost so much weight, but God sent me a wonderful friend, one of my peers in my class, and also a wonderful teacher who dared to be kind to me. They both helped me over all these trying moments. And my
and they actually gave you some food, did they not?
Yeah. Ruth Conrad, her mother would send, in fact, they would invite me to their home and feed me. And Ruth would bring things to school for me to eat. And I didn't dare to bring it home, so I used to go to alleyways and squat behind garbage cans and eat that food. It was really pretty gruesome. So I never said anything to my mother. I didn't want to worry her. But one day it was so bad that I called my pastor. And I said, "Pastor," and I was sobbing. And he said, "Anita, why didn't you tell me that sooner?" And I said, "I didn't want to worry you, and I didn't want to worry my mother." Well, he said, "I will write to this lady, and I will ask her to pay for your return fare to your hometown, and we want you to come back home." And I did, and I was so glad when I left there. I left my precious friend behind, but we stayed in touch with each other by mail. And when I got home, three of my mother's older sisters had moved in with her, but there was still room on the Davenport. And it didn't matter how many bed bugs bit at night and how crowded we were and how the rations were getting less and less. We were all together, but it was disheartening to see one after another of my mother's three sisters were taken away, and it was so heart-rending. And we had already heard that my mother came from a very large family. She was the youngest of seven, and more we heard about her older brother and his wife and my precious relatives in Berlin. They were already all picked up. It was, and friends, one day, you know, one day you meet somebody and you love them, and the next day they were taken away. Well, in the place where we lived, we moved there in 1939. No, it was Christmas of 1938. And it's very interesting. It was in the following Christmas in 1943, I had an interesting dream. It was in the 10 holy nights. In Germany, we always 12 holy nights, from Christmas Eve to the 6th of January. In that dream, I was dreaming that my mother and I were packing hat boxes, old hat boxes, with meager belongings, and we dashed off. And when we came to a big, huge body of water, there we saw a very, very large ocean liner packed with people. They all looked the same to me because they'd already been traveling for quite a ways from the shore into the middle of the ocean, but we could still see them waving to us. And at one moment, I turned around to look if my hat box was still there. And when I turned back, my mother was gone too. She was on that boat too. And I stood there all by myself and looked up to heaven, and it was very, very overcast, very cold, the 7th of January. No, it wasn't yet. It was still in, I'm sorry, I take that back. It was still in the first night, a holy night in, it's 43. And I couldn't understand, what does this dream mean? Only to find out, on the 7th of January, my mother and I got up to go to the factory early in the morning. It was still dark outside, and suddenly there was a knock at the door that we had heard so many times. and when the door would be opened of the apartment that housed four families, one living in each room, we always would see two men in SS uniform marching in and picking out either one person out of a family or the entire family. And it was just my mother and I that were left in that one room.
And had you had to watch your aunts who were picked up, did you have to watch the Gestapo come to your place to do that?
Yes. Mm-hmm. They came to the room and told them, hurry up. And they told her how much of her belongings she could bring, would be only clothes and other necessities. And then they would say, hurry, hurry, and then they would take him. And when we looked out the window, we would see the police wagon hauling them off. It was just like hauling cattle to the slaughter. But this time they came for my mother, the 7th of January, 1944. I was 16 years old. But I was allowed to escort her in the police wagon to the synagogue in town, in the center of town, the only synagogue that had not been burned in 1938. But then when we reached the synagogue, I had to let her go. And it was very hard. But I knew that she had become a Christian, and she was so strong. I was the one that wept, but she didn't. She tried to be strong for the both of us. And she said, don't worry, Anita, someday we will meet again. And then I remembered what Pastor Hornig had said to us. Even if a death camp would be either for both of you or either one of you, remember, death is but the door to eternal life. But still, it was tough. I needed my mother, but I had to grow up awfully fast, and I took care of myself.
And backtracking for a minute, to see the portrait of your mother, because there were some Christ-like things she had done after she was a Christian, hope that you will tell about that very special Christmas time when the dwarf came to the door.
Oh, that was beautiful. Yeah, that I can't remember exactly. That must have been about 1938, maybe, Christmas of 1938. There was in those days we had people called peddlers. They came with certain goods that they sold. And this lady was a dwarf. And she came with her two heavy bags, and it was a cold, cold night, short before Christmas. And my mother had only one pair of gloves. And then she saw that poor woman's hands so discolored from the frost that not only did she buy some notions like needles and thread and stuff, but she also asked her to come in, and she says, come sit down and, you know, keep warm. And she gave her one of hers. She had only one scarf, and she gave this to the lady, and she gave her gloves that she had. And as, like I said, it was short before Christmas. And then she gave her literally our last meal to eat. We had only one meal that we had fixed for the next day. And when she finally left, my mother says, God be with you, and next time you come, I will do the same thing for you. And the lady was so grateful. Well, when the lady had left, my sister and I looked at my mom and said, Mom, what are we going to do to eat tomorrow? Oh, she says, don't worry, the Lord will provide. I mean, that was after she had made her commitment to Christ. And sure enough, the next day, this brings tears to my eyes. It was so awesome. One of the ladies, the Aryan lady that was always kind to us, she knocked at the door the next day, knowing nothing of what had happened, you know, the incidents with this lady that my mother had fed. And she knocked at the door. Oh, she said, Hilda, my sister sent me meat and carrots and potatoes. And she said, and I cooked them, and I made a big pot of stew. and there is enough for my husband and me and for you and the kids. And she brought that over, and then she bought, I had to sell my toys and many of my things, and she, because we had to move to the inner city ghetto, we couldn't stay in where we were staying. They kicked all the Jewish people out of that place. And so she paid my, double for what my mother asked. So here God was, my mother was right. The Lord will provide. He provided for us to be fed and to have a few extra pennies.
And again, the Bible tells us if we are merciful, we receive mercy.
Yes.
And so, you know, we probably have about 8 minutes left in this part one. And I'd like to get back now to the story of the synagogue. And you had a special friend you were saying goodbye to, too. And
oh, yeah.
We'll talk about that, and we'll talk about the special robe that you gave your mother. Let's talk about what happened after your mother was taken to the synagogue.
After my mother was taken to the synagogue, I went to my pastor right away, and he said, go sit down, dear, she said. Let my wife fix some sandwiches for you that you could take to your mother. And I said, yeah, and I have to go home after that before I see my mother because I have her bathrobe. She forgot her bathrobe. So I packed it all up into one bag, and then I drove off. I took the streetcar and rode down to the synagogue, and there I found many, many young people, and I recognized one of my childhood friends that I hadn't seen for many years. And we stuck together, and then there were some other people that we made friends with during that time. We were waiting outside the synagogue, hoping and begging and pleading that they would let us in. But the guards had their orders. They couldn't let us in. So we prayed over it. And well, one of the boys that, one of the three brothers that we had become friends with before this happened, their mother was in there too. And he said, you know, I know the place. There is a big building that's attached to the synagogue and that they had always been used for school for the Jewish kids. And there is a tunnel that connects the synagogue with the tunnel. And let's go in there. And they have made it, the Nazis made it into a hotel. And he said, let's go and see if they would let us in, and we won't tell them what we are going to do. And so he, I know, we asked for some name, and they said, well, I don't know. The girl said, I have to look in the book. And while she was looking, the rest of us, this one, one young man stayed there, so that the rest of us could go through the tunnel. And then he, too, escaped from the tunnel. But the people that operated that hotel must have known that we had gone into the tunnel. They might have seen us. And pretty soon, but we got to the end of the tunnel. There was a door, but the door was slightly open that led into the synagogue. We know we couldn't go in, but we saw a lady walking inside there. And first there was a guard there, and he left. And then the lady came, an older lady, and we motioned her quietly to come over. And we gave all our goodies that we had for our mothers to give to our mothers. And she promised she would deliver that. But in the meantime, when we were going to go back out of the tunnel, we saw big flashlights pointing at us, and they were two Gestapo officials, and they picked us up and brought us before the head of the Gestapo, and we were being interrogated. And I know my friend Steffi broke down and cried, and she said, sir, she said, we did not want any harm. Yeah, he said, I could put you in prison right now. This is harboring fugitives. She said, we all said we had nothing like that in our mind. We just wanted to give one last thing to be taken to our mothers before they were going to be shipped up the next day. Well, I tell you, our hearts were almost standing still, but the Gestapo official would not let go but what he threatened, and he said he asked one of the Gestapo officials to watch us, and they lined us up against the wall, and then all the others went into another room, and they talked with each other. So then when they came out, they had decided that they would let us go, but that we would be on the blacklist of the Gestapo, and he warned us, he said, "But you better watch yourself, because the next time we're going to pick you up and you're going to ship you off to Auschwitz," which was a death camp. So we had formed a wonderful circle of friendship, and we would meet once a week on Sundays, usually, in each other's apartments, and be together and share our letters that we had received. At first, I didn't know where they had taken my mother. And then I found out after a few weeks where they had taken her to Camp Theresienstadt in Czechoslovakia. And one good thing, the people, the prisoners, were able to receive some food packages every now and then.
And we'll get into that more probably in the next interview. But also, before your mother left, we just have about 2 minutes, she was able to alert you somehow to get in touch with your father, wasn't she?
Yes. Excuse me. Let me take a sip of water here.
Certainly. When the Gestapo came, what did she do?
Yeah. She was able to go to the bathroom, and then she asked the man, one of the two guards that were standing there waiting for her to go to the bathroom, she said, "I will be back right away." And when she came back, she handed me a piece of paper, and the two officials were talking to each other. They didn't see it, and she whispered to me, "This is your father's phone number, and call him and ask him if he could come and help you." Because what had happened was, when the Gestapo came at first, they dragged my mother back into the room after she had opened the door for them, set her down harshly, and gave her a form to fill out. And she had to swear and list that every item in that room would be now, that every item was her property. And they put red labels on every item. And they told me that the only thing I was allowed to keep was my bed, my clothes, and my very personal possessions. Everything else would be picked up the next day, taken to the headquarters warehouse, the headquarters of the Gestapo warehouse, and then they would, if I wanted anything back, I had to come over there to the headquarters and pay for every item that they had taken, pay out of my own pocket. And I didn't have that kind of money working as a slave labor person in a factory. So I was able.
And, you know, here we can see the face of tyranny. It was a little bit like Marxism, I think. And, you know, in part two, we're going to pick up the story of you on your own, what happened to you next, and how God miraculously enabled you to get something sent to your mother.
I think
we're running out of time, and we do want to mention again your book, Trapped in Hitler's Hell, and we hope that people will call 866-876-3910, 866-876-3910, to order Trapped in Hitler's Hell. Anita, you've become such a beloved friend, and you've meant so much in my own life. Thank you for this part one.
And thank you for inviting me again. I love you, and thank you.
I love you too.
Listen.
And thank you, listeners. This is a real, real milestone. Good night for the Divided Kingdom.